For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is the very first of the new, I don't know what you call them, Scott Horton interviews for Radio Chaos, and also the new daily podcast, hopefully, for antiwar.com. And I'm very honored that our first guest will be Robert Dreyfuss. He's a freelance reporter. He writes for Rolling Stone, The Nation, Mother Jones, and Tom Paine, among others. His book is called Devil's Game: How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And Bob, I'm going to have to interview you about that book some other time, because right now we have very current news that I'd like your analysis on. I guess particularly starting with your article from last week, Bush's meeting with a murderer, about Bush's meeting with Abdulaziz Hakim from the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq last Monday. And the story that basically they're working on a coup d'etat, a new nationalist government of national salvation, they call it, to replace the government of Prime Minister Maliki. There's an article yesterday in the Associated Press that talked about a different coalition of people who are going to try to replace Maliki. And then today we read in the New York Times that there's a White House plan to bolster Maliki by trying to get the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution to back him, the Dawa Party prime minister, so that he will not have to rely anymore on Muqtada al-Sadr. And I just thought, wow, what a mess. As Iraq completely falls apart, and everybody is scurrying and grabbing for power, I guess it'd be interesting to see who you think stands the best chance of coming out on top, or maybe you can help describe who these different factions are and how powerful they are and what their motives are.
Well, I guess there's you know, two ways to answer that question. I would say the most important aspect of it is that Iraqi politics is divided between people who want the United States to stay in Iraq and continue the occupation and people who want us to leave. I would say that the anti-occupation sentiment in Iraq is by far the majority. In other words, just as I think most Americans have come to the end of their rope on Iraq and want the United States to withdraw, I think the overwhelming majority of Iraqis want the United States to withdraw. And as Zbigniew Brzezinski has said, the former national security advisor, the people who want the United States to stay in Iraq, that is among the Iraqis, the people who want us to stay are the ones who'd have to leave if we leave. We're, by our occupation, propping up a government that has very little legitimacy inside Iraq. Most of the Sunnis, including those who are fighting us, of course want the United States to withdraw. Most of the Shiites, including those who support Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical cleric who has twice launched rebellions in the last 3.5 years. Most of the Shiites also want us to leave. I think probably a lot of the Kurds up in the north want us to stay. But among the Arabs, both the Sunnis and the Shiites, there's a strong majority that wants the United States to pull out. So the problem is, how does the United States form a government of Iraqi politicians who want to endorse and continue to support the occupation? That is a very difficult task. What President Bush is trying to do now, as he apparently decides to try to continue the occupation, is to put together a government that would be another reshuffling of the traditional politicians who've run Iraq since the U.S. occupation began almost 4 years ago, to reshuffle that coalition, probably to get rid of Prime Minister Maliki and to replace him with some other people who I guess would be more prepared to distance that government from Sudder, because Muqtada Sudder, the cleric that I mentioned, has become kind of a radical. So all of this reshuffling is just another way of saying that the Bush administration seems intent on prolonging the occupation and is once again looking for Iraqi politicians who will go along. I don't know how successful they can be, because any government that we help put in power and that we install is going to have very little credibility among Iraqis, who will see it as yet another American puppet government.
This is basically what Stephen Hadley's leaked memo talked about a couple of weeks ago, right? That they need to reshuffle the deck to give Maliki from the Dawa Party an entirely new base of support aside from Sadr's Mahdi army. Only, wasn't that idea roundly ridiculed when Hadley's memo was leaked just a couple of weeks ago? Because, you know, Maliki is who he is. He's the Dawa Party guy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Dawa Party, the problem with the Dawa Party, it doesn't have any militia. It doesn't have any armed force underneath it. So Maliki has to rely on one of the two big Shiite powers, either Sadr or this Hakim faction, Abdulaziz Hakim, who was in the United States last week and who is the head of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Well, those two guys, both clergymen, have big militias that support their parties. So Maliki has to rely on one or the other, and it looks like the powers that be in Washington have pretty much given up on Prime Minister Maliki. They don't think he has the ability to crack down on Sadr, and they don't think he has the ability to mobilize these Iraqi security forces against the insurgency. So in both cases, I think they see him as weak and becoming close to useless. So what they're going to try to do, I think, is put together another coalition. I don't think it can work. And I mean, maybe, you know, Hadley's memo was accurate at the time, but things are moving very fast. When Prime Minister Maliki went to visit Bush in Jordan, when President Bush was there after the NATO meeting, Sadr pulled out his 30 members of parliament and his 5 cabinet ministers out of the Iraqi government. And so he has basically withdrawn support for the Maliki government, pushing, I guess, a little closer toward a confrontation. And not only that, he's reached out to some of the Sunni opposition groups across the Sunni-Shiite divide to see whether there would be some sort of common ground there, that is, where both parties might oppose the occupation and might see, you know, a common ground in asking the United States to pull out of Iraq. Because don't forget, we're in Iraq now, at least theoretically, because the Iraqi government has asked us to stay. And the minute the Iraqi government turns around and says, we want you guys out, then we pretty much got to get out, and pretty quick. So I don't know how Iraqi politics is going to go, but I think it's clear that the Bush administration is pretty desperately scrambling to try to come up with some kind of workable coalition. I'm pessimistic that they can do it.
Well, is it correct that the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party basically favor having extreme federalism or whatever, basically almost pure autonomy for the Shiite South, and that Sadr is really the only Shiite leader of any prominence who's actually an Iraqi nationalist, if we remember back to April of 04, I think it was April of 04, the first Battle of Fallujah, where Muqtada al-Sadr sent his Shiite fighters, as few as there were of them back then, to go and help the Sunnis up in Fallujah. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and their body brigades, meanwhile, have been, and I suppose to a degree the Mahdi Army too, have been waging the death squad campaign against the Sunnis.
Yeah, I mean, that alliance over Fallujah was, you know, 2.5 years ago, and I'm not sure that it would still hold up. On the other hand, I think it's important to point out that you're right, Abdulaziz Hakim, the Supreme Council people, are the most radical in demanding the breakup of Iraq and the creation of a basically a Shiite republic in the southern half of the country, which happens to be where about two-thirds of Iraq's oil is located. They in turn get a lot of support from Iran. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq was created inside Iran in the 1980s, during the Iran-Iraq War. And they were made up of Iraqi prisoners of war who decided to cast their lot with Iran, and who in turn became both terrorists and torturers of other Iraqi prisoners. Throughout the 1980s, they still maintain ties to Iran and get military and financial help from Iran.
So why is America backing the also Iran-backed separatists rather than the nationalists among the Shiite majority?
Well, ironically, because the nationalists are the ones who don't like us most and who want us to pull out of Iraq and turn it over to Iraqis. And it's the Supreme Council, which, although it has close ties to Iran, is basically willing to cooperate with the American occupation as long as the United States continues to build them up and support them. But the problem is, when we invaded Iraq, we found out that our favored allies, the ones we thought would take power, had no political support. And so in an emergency, we turned to the Supreme Council and to its forces among the Shiites and to the two big Kurdish parties as our primary allies. The fact that they had ties to Iran was something that I guess we weren't happy about. The Bush administration wasn't thrilled about, but it was something that they had no alternative to do unless they were going to quickly turn around and get out of Iraq. So now we're stuck, as long as we want to stay in Iraq, we're stuck with this pro-Iranian coalition, and they're willing to work with us as long as we keep building up them up and supporting them and working with them. So we're caught in a paradox here. And the Iranians are content to sit back and let us stew in this paradox. Okay, as long as the United States is fighting the Sunnis and fighting our enemies and fighting Iraqi nationalists, then they're making common cause with us. So you have this paradox of Bush saying he doesn't even want to talk to Iran, and meanwhile doing everything he can in Iran to help the Iranians with their allies. So it's an absurd situation, but there you are, because there's no other forces that will support the American presence in Iraq.
Yes, a friend pointed out to me that there's really only one group in Iraq that could possibly give the United States victory, as Bush defines it, which is holding Iraq together into one country, ending the civil war, fighting Al-Qaeda, and limiting the influence of Iran. And those are the Ba'athists, the people America invaded to overthrow.
Well, except the problem is the Ba'athists right now have made common cause with the Sunnis, so they're only a part of the equation anymore in Iraq. And
so you're saying even if the Sunni were to gain power, it wouldn't be the Ba'athists, it would be the religious leaders, really.
Well, what I'm saying is the Sunnis can't gain power in Iraq as representing only 20% of the population, unless they could establish some sort of dictatorship again that would violently suppress the Shiites once again and bring the Kurds back into Iraq. But I don't see any mechanism for that to happen. I do think that it's possible for the United States to talk to the Ba'athists and to other Sunni armed resistance elements and insurgents and work out some sort of truce on that side of the fence in Iraq. And once we do that, once we can arrange some sort of deal with the Sunnis, then I think that the Shiites might be more willing to put down their arms and turn away from some of the militia groups that they have been supporting so far. So, I mean, to the extent that there's some kind of national reconciliation that could happen, I think it would happen built around a Sunni-Shiite agreement. I don't know whether we, the United States, has any role to play in helping to put that together. I think that's more something that would be up to the United Nations and the Arab League and other international parties that you know, would have a lot more credibility than we would have in dealing with various, you know, political forces in Iraq.
In terms of the Shiite death squads, was this not a result, and really the civil war itself, was this not a direct result of the policy that they announced, I guess, a year and a half, 2 years ago, called the El Salvador option? We have to use local Iraqis who know the terrain and know the enemy to kill them efficiently to stop this insurgency.
You know, there's no doubt that the United States is primarily interested, at least the Bush administration, in fighting the Sunnis and the insurgency. And so as a result, I don't think we're too concerned about the death squads that are targeting specific Sunni leaders and clerics and others. On the other hand, I think that the Bush administration by now has begun to figure out that the larger sectarian war, that is where Sunnis and Shiites just kill each other based on some kind of frenzied religious identity, that undermines the ability of the United States to bring Iraq under its control. So I guess what I'm saying is that some of the death squad activity that's aimed at leaders and particular, you know, senior figures among the Sunnis and among the resistance, I doubt we're too unhappy with the fact that that's happening. But I think it's the broader sectarian crisis which has now become a dangerous and potentially, you know, spiraling out of control situation.
Right, and I hate to say it, but Bush is actually partially correct, although it's sort of beside the point now, but people made fun of him a couple of weeks ago for insisting that Al-Qaeda was doing everything they could to encourage sectarian division. But that's really correct, isn't it, that al-Zarqawi deliberately bombed Shiite mosques and that kind of thing to prevent Iraqi nationalism from being able to overcome the sectarian differences?
Well, that's correct. Where Bush is wrong is when he argues that Al-Qaeda is a significant part of the Sunni resistance, and that if we leave Iraq, we're going to be handing Iraq over to Al-Qaeda. I mean, that is utter nonsense. The Al-Qaeda forces among the Sunnis are a tiny, tiny minority. And the minute we leave Iraq, they will be obliterated by the Sunni majority, which has no use for these kind of extremists.
The Shiites, you mean?
No, even the Sunnis.
Oh, you mean...
The Sunni tribal leaders and the Ba'athists and most of the nationalists on the Sunni side don't support Al-Qaeda at all. They see them as a dangerous renegade force. So the idea that Al-Qaeda would take over Iraq if we leave is silly. And of course, as you point out, the Shiites too would mightily resist Al-Qaeda and all of its allies. So they're not a threat, except their ability to, let's say, yes, blow up a mosque or set off a car bomb in the middle of a marketplace and try to, you know, inflame passions even further. But there's a lot of people who understand that game, and I don't think it would have gotten so far had the United States not gone into Iraq with this sectarian view in mind of apportioning out ministries and control to, you know, on a Sunni versus Shiite versus Kurdish basis. We could have gone in and tried to collect leaders who were competent regardless of their religious and ethnic affiliations, and tried to encourage authentic Iraqi leaders to come forward, as opposed to just looking and saying, okay, we're going to pick, you know, these two Shiites and these two Kurds and these three Sunnis and you know, put them all together, and if one of them leaves, we'll find another Shiite. I mean, but we were encouraging this sectarianism.
Well, and that's even how the
occupation.
That's even how the elections were held, right? That all the there weren't even names of candidates on the list. It was either vote Shiite party, Sunni party, or Kurd party on the ballot.
Well, right, but the elections came, you know, 2 years after the occupation started.
Yeah, but I mean, this is an ongoing thing. Is that America's policy has encouraged all of this sectarianism rather than fighting?
Absolutely, we've helped create it.
When Dick Cheney met King Abdullah a couple of weeks ago, the word was that he was warned that if America cannot protect the Sunni minority in Iraq, that Saudi Arabia and Egypt will. And so isn't it the case now that the American soldiers in Iraq are actually there to protect the Sunni minority that they're fighting from the majority that they've put in power?
Well, you know, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, I don't think we have much of a clue about what we're doing. We've shifted back and forth between trying to build up the Shiite power to then talk to the Sunnis to support the Kurds, to try to build up the police force and then to purge it and then build up the army and then try to redo it. I mean, we're flailing all over the place. I think we've made such a mess in Iraq. We've done so many things so wrong, so badly, that it's impossible now to sort out this puzzle. It's like anything we do instantly has a reaction in the other direction. If we show favoritism toward the Sunnis, then the Shiites instantly get angry at us. And if we tilt toward the Shiites, then we push all of the Sunnis into the arms of the armed resistance. So everything we're doing is making the situation worse. And we don't seem to have any ability to figure that out.
Do you fear the regionalization of the sectarian war in Iraq?
Oh, it's very possible. It might even be likely. That's why all of the plans, all of the exit strategies for getting out of Iraq start and end with the notion of diplomacy and working with Iraq's neighbors and an international conference and all of that to at least contain the violence. In other words, at least if we can't stop the fighting inside Iraq among the different populations, to at least contain it so that the neighbors aren't drawn in. But I don't think that there's any way of guaranteeing that won't happen. The Sunni Arabs in Jordan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, as well as in Syria, would be drawn in to support the Sunnis if a true all-out civil war erupted with no American army there. And by the same token, I think the Iranians would intervene in a much more significant way to support their clients. And of course, you have the possibility of Turkey getting involved to prevent the Kurds in the north of Iraq from declaring an independent state, because there are so many Kurds in Turkey that the Turks feel that they could become a threat to Turkish national security too. So, so all of this is a tangle that I think has no solution short of a decision by the United States to get out of Iraq, and that's what I'm suggesting ought to happen.
It's interesting you bring up the knot up there with the Kurds and Turkey. America was actually heavily criticized in the 1990s for backing the Turkish government's suppression of the Kurds, basically almost full-scale war against their Kurdish population, our loyal NATO ally of 50 years, the Turks. Are we ready to stab them in the back now?
I don't know. I think we'd do anything and everything to fix the Iraq problem, and yet it seems like everything we're doing is making it even worse. So the Turks are already angry at us. As you know, they refused permission at the beginning of the war for the United States to use Turkey as a staging ground to invade Iraq. I think they're extremely unhappy in Turkey about the growth of Kurdish separatism, and not only that, there are Kurdish extremist groups that are launching attacks inside Turkey, terrorist style attacks that are taking refuge in the Kurdish areas of Iraq. The same thing is true in Iran. You have Kurdish groups in Iraq that are supporting attacks and violence inside Iran as well, and there have been
the same groups.
No, different groups. The Turkish groups are Turkish oriented. The Iranian groups have ties to Iranian Kurds, but they both, you know, have bases in the areas of Iraq that border respectively on those two countries. So both Iran and Turkey are not exactly thrilled over the possibility of the Kurds getting more independence in Iraq. So that adds another dimension to the complexity of this.
Now, you quote Frank Gaffney on your blog. It's robertdreyfuss.com/blog. And you quote him saying that, well, this is nothing but political cover for retreat. And you say, well, you're right about that, and let's hope they take it. Do you have any serious hopefulness that the Bush administration will take the James Baker report for basically the political cover that it is to admit defeat and leave? Hell, they could even call it victory, right, and then leave.
I did at first when the Baker team was putting together its report, and I was hopeful, and now I'm becoming less and less hopeful. On the one hand, you have almost the entire world, most of the U.S. Congress, virtually all of the Democrats and many Republicans, public opinion in the United States, which is turning overwhelmingly against Bush on the Iraq war, the U.S. military, which is unhappy with the way the war is going. I mean, all of these reality-based forces are pushing the president to not necessarily accept the Baker-Hamilton report in complete, but to acknowledge the fact that we've got to turn around and start withdrawing, as opposed to, you know, his insistence, the president's insistence on victory all the time. I was hopeful that all that pressure from reality would cause the president to, you know, change his views. Now he's engaged in a big review inside the government of options toward Iraq, and it seems like more and more, and possibly under the influence of Vice President Cheney, that he's not going to change his mind. I don't know if he thinks there's some miracle he can pull off or some way he can solve the problem, because I know the president now is aware of how bad the situation is. But he's got to understand that if he goes into 2008 with this war continuing, and that's only a year from now, continuing like it is, that the Republicans are going to suffer a massive defeat in a presidential election which will be far worse than the defeat they just suffered in the midterm election. So I think from a political standpoint, the Republican pressure on President Bush is going to be enormous, and at some point, the Republican establishment, the people from the Senate like John Warner and others, are going to have to go into the White House. And if it doesn't happen this month, it's going to happen in January or February or March, and say, Mr. President, we've had it, and either you get out of Iraq or we're going to join with the Democrats to force you to do it. I don't see any alternative if the president continues to resist reality than an outright revolt in Congress against his policies.
And perhaps even a cutting off of funds?
Well, they might not have to go that far, but there's a lot that Congress can do to make it clear how unhappy it is. And there are ways of, putting conditions on funds and other kinds of things that, but to use the power of their control over money and over the budget process, and other kinds of things. During past wars, Congress issued, very explicit rules preventing the military from doing X, Y, and Z in regard to the Contras and in regard to Angola in Africa and in other cases where, they basically blocked the freedom of the administration. And so, yeah, they could do it in the case of Iraq, too.
All right. Thank you very much. Always appreciate hearing your perspective. Robert Dreyfus, he's a freelance reporter. You can find him in Rolling Stone, The Nation, Mother Jones, and TomPaine.com. His website is RobertDreyfus.com, and his blog is RobertDreyfus.com/blog. And everyone, highest recommendation, top of the list, Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Scott.